surface as if to chastise me. "And they litter," she says, "a lot. You can't see it here, but there's a road back that way through the trees, and Jody says the cops patrol around here because they know kids like to come here to get in trouble." She sweeps her net through the water in a slow, graceful arc. She pulls it up, and the water gushes down through the net, leaving behind two green glass bottles. "And either these kids hate the planet, or else when they see the headlights, they throw their shit out here. Maybe it's both, what do I know?"
"Bummer," I say.
"There we go," Margaret replies. "There's a frown. I'm much more familiar with that expression. It's comforting, even. We'll make a cynic out of you yet." "Good luck," I say, dropping my net into the water on the other side of the boat.
While I'm swooshing it around, she opens up a trash bag and dumps her bounty into it. Under the surface, I catch something too. A little whoop of excitement escapes me.
"Reel her in,"
Margaret orders, and I lift the net upward, water pouring through it to reveal a neon green rubber clog. A croc, or an off-brand version of the same thing.
"I hope no one's missing this," I say. "I guarantee they're not," Margaret replies, and opens another trash bag. "Here,"
she thrusts it toward me.
"For all the trash we can't use."
I drop the shoe into it. "So should we get started?" She sighs, like the thought exhausts her, and I wonder for the millionth time why she agreed to this, if she's genuinely still considering my original proposition, or if she's already checked out. "How are you feeling about the interview process?"
"I've been dreading today."
"Really? Why?" I ask.
"Because," she says with a small shrug, "we're coming up on all my greatest mistakes."
I frown. Is that how she'd categorize it? Her epic, highly documented love story?
"Guess we might as well get to it," she says. "But keep working while we talk. There's plenty more shit in the creek."
"I'm not sure that's how the saying goes," I say.
"Should be, though, shouldn't it?"
The story. Their version. In 1958, as Gerald Ives lay dying, his granddaughters were out drinking and dancing until the sun came up. Her version. One perfect night. That was what Margaret needed to give Laura to shake her out of her isolation, to bring her out of the gilded tomb that was the House of Ives and into the land of the living. It started with the head gardener. Daniel lived on the Ives property, but he had a truck, and it wasn't uncommon for him to make deliveries and pickups from nurseries between the glimmering coast where the House of Ives sat perched and downtown Los Angeles. Leaving with Margaret's usual car and driver was out of the question. That thing had become a press magnet, and while ordinarily she figured the cameras would find her no matter what, so she might as well cut to the chase and pose, she knew that sort of attention would send Laura skittering home, more determined than ever to hide from life. So Margaret's driver, Darren, was out. Daniel, the gardener, was in.
"He'll take us off property in the back of his truck," she told her sister. "We'll wear disguises and everything, like we're spies."
Laura was hesitant, but when wasn't she these days?
"Gerald isn't doing well," she said, because the girls had been raised to call their grandfather by his first name rather than a more affectionate nickname. "I don't know about leaving him alone."
"He won't be alone," Margaret said, which was true because there were always people in the house, even if primarily those people were staff.
"He doesn't like anyone else, really," Laura pointed out.
"And they don't like him either," Margaret said. "A match made in heaven." At that, Laura gave a begrudging laugh. It made Margaret's heart leap with hope. "We'll ask Mom to come sit with him for a while. He likes Mom." An exaggeration, but only slightly. Gerald had disapproved of his son's marriage, but disapproved far more of his divorce, and in the years since, he'd adamantly refused to learn any of Freddie's partner's names and showed a clear preference for Bernie over his son during family dinners.
"One night," Margaret whispered eagerly, clasping Laura's hands in hers.
She saw the moment she won her sister over. She had a knack for that sort of thing, reading people.
In her mind, she was already celebrating before Laura ever said the breathless, exhilarated words, "I wonder what he's like in person." He, of course, being Cosmo Sinclair, whose concert they'd be attending. Margaret fought a powerful urge to roll her eyes. She'd had plenty of gentlemen friends over the years, had plenty of fun with them even, but she knew Cosmo Sinclair's type. Preening, self-important, and with enough sparkle to hide the fact that his skull was more or less a wind tunnel. But that didn't matter. Cosmo was a means to an end, and that means had just done its job. She got the wigs from her mother's studio, and as for the clothes they'd wear, she'd asked the housekeeper to buy them each a dress straight off the rack at Bullock's. Something pink for Laura, because it would bring out the glow in her cheeks, and something drab for Margaret, because anything too colorful or glamorous might too clearly read Peggy Ives, rather than anonymous concert goer. On the night of the concert, the two lay in the bed of Daniel's truck with a scratchy wool blanket pulled over them, and they rumbled off the property, right past the row of not-so-patiently waiting photographers who'd started gathering outside their tall iron gates. A friend of his, handsomely paid for his discretion, met the girls on the side of a road and drove them toward Pan Pacific. Not to, toward. It felt like overkill to Margaret, treating themselves like Audrey Hepburn's Princess Anne in Roman Holiday, but the subterfuge was both a fun game and a way to make Laura feel more comfortable. Maybe, she thought, this could even become a tradition of theirs. Daniel's friend dropped them at a burger joint, and Laura hovered close to Margaret's shoulder, intimidated rather than comforted by the excess of rowdy young people eating and socializing at the counter.
"It's too crowded," Laura whimpered. "Someone will recognize us."
"Why would they?" Margaret said. "We've never been anywhere like this in our lives." They ate their burgers and drank their sodas in a corner booth. Laura was quiet and watchful at first, but when Margaret bumped her ankle to her sister's and said, "What do you think Cosmo is doing right now?" Laura gave a meek smile. "Oh, that's right," Margaret said. "I'm sure he's pomading his hair right up until showtime." And this earned a real belly laugh from Laura.
"I know, you think he's ridiculous."
"Of course I do," Margaret allowed. "But most men are. Look at our father." Laura gave her an amused yet reproachful look, but she didn't disagree. After a second, she said,
"Roy's not ridiculous."
No, he's not," Margaret agreed of their stepfather. "But then Roy's not the sort of man they let up on a stage with a microphone." Laura tittered.
"Can you imagine?"
"I can, and it's a tragedy, Laura." The picture of their mother's even-keeled and soft-spoken husband wailing on a guitar, a lock of Cosmo-style hair falling across his forehead, made them both howl with laughter. "More than that, picture Mom watching him from the audience." It was too easy to imagine the highly practical Doris Bernhardt observing the spectacle, horrified. When Laura's laughter finally settled and she wiped the tears from her eyes, she said thoughtfully,
"Although, I suppose Dad's always been a bit of a showman, and she loved him once, didn't she?"
It made Margaret's heart ache to realize her sister didn't have those precious memories from the early years that meant so much to Margaret herself, that she couldn't recall the day she'd first toddled across the grass and Freddie, Bernie, and Margaret cheered on the smallest of their band. They'd eaten ice cream sundaes, down in one of the kitchens to celebrate, the girls sitting up on the long oak prep table.
"Not that she doesn't love him now," Laura added. "I only mean they were in love, weren't they?"
"I think so, yes," Margaret said. "And if they weren't, they were still happy." The truth was, Margaret wasn't sure she knew precisely what love was. Sometimes she lay awake at night, thinking about the word until it came apart like little bits of alphabet soup, the letters drifting off in opposite directions, and the meaning lost somewhere in the gaps. She knew she felt an almost feral protectiveness of her sister. She knew she admired her mother, thought her quite possibly the loveliest woman in the world, though she'd heard and read enough to know the world at large didn't agree with this assessment. And she knew that though she no longer felt close to her father, not deeply known by or deeply knowledgeable of him, she'd felt a kind of peace every time she'd sat opposite him in the drawing room, playing chess while the fire popped and crackled in the grate. She knew what it was to have fun drinking and dancing with a man, and that occasionally there was a fair amount of pleasure to be had doing other things with one. But love? She didn't know what it was, and she couldn't imagine being in it the way people described. And the joy of having two parents who were not only ludicrously wealthy but also extremely eccentric was that no one in her family minded much whether she fell in love and got married or not. Look at Aunt Francine. She was 53 years old and had never been married. And then there was Great Aunt Gigi, who at 75 had never bothered to remarry after her first husband's death, instead spending most weekends during Margaret's youth either at the ballet or entertaining some attractive male ballet dancer or another in her rooms at the house. And Bernie had certainly never pushed either of her daughters toward matrimony. If anything, Margaret had occasionally felt as though her mother hoped Margaret might fall in love with filmmaking the way Bernie herself had, but even that romance evaded her. She and Laura finished their burgers and shakes in a thoughtful quiet, then walked down the street to hail a cab. As long as they'd lived, they'd had a dedicated driver, and lifting her hand as she stepped off the curb triggered a delicious thrill in Margaret's chest. She felt, for the first time in a long time, the distinct possibility of getting it wrong, of trying something new in a world that wouldn't bend for you. In the back seat of the cab, the sisters grinned at each other and clasped each other's hands tightly, and Margaret knew Laura felt it too. It made her feel young again. She wasn't a socialite, wasn't the tabloid princess. She was one of two giggly sisters playing make-believe or hatching a prank on their good-spirited father, like the time they'd filled his shoes with eggs and hidden around the corner to watch the moment he stuffed his foot into the leather. They made it to the Pan Pacific without a hitch and joined the mass of people pouring toward the recently opened doors of the green and white building. Laura tensed again, but the thrill in Margaret's chest only renewed. Had she ever waited in line before? Not that this was a line, per se. It was more like a thousand different lines, all colliding and dividing in every direction as the crowd jostled forward. Margaret could sense Laura's nerves, but she thought she could feel her excitement, too. The Ives sisters might possibly have been the richest people in that room of thousands, but they were far from the most famous. The private boxes packed with movie stars and professional ball players, other singers, and no one seemed interested in craning their necks to catch a glimpse of anyone other than the one person they'd come to see. Even Margaret got caught up in the energy of the crowd. The whole first half of the show was dedicated to a series of opening acts, and while the audience didn't seem interested, she noted the way the entire crowd kept their eyes bouncing between the stage and the wings. She caught herself doing the same, watching for Cosmo, wondering how he could ever live up to the myth and legend. How would thousands of people not leave here tonight disappointed? She couldn't imagine it ending any other way. Every time one of the openers asked some variation of the question, "Who here's excited about seeing Mr. Cosmo Sinclair?" the audience response rivaled the roar of a jet engine. The floor trembled. When the last group had played and left the stage, the lights dimmed, as they had between each of the acts, and then the dim melted into outright jet black darkness. The screaming of the audience started up again. This time, it didn't sound so much like excitement as sheer desperation, as if the need had grown too much to bear, a joy that verged on terror. Her whole body erupted into goose pimples. And then a fierce white light flared out, and a coyly smirking man in all black came into focus at a microphone dead center of the stage. Margaret had never heard anything like the overwhelming screech of the thousands of people in that room. She realized Laura was screaming too, her eyes saucer wide, one splayed hand pressed over her lips, but doing nothing to stop the sound. Margaret let herself join in, laughing and screaming and laughing some more. She felt as if they'd all been caught in the same riptide, like her emotions didn't belong to her, but she didn't mind. It was fun to feel so much. Behind Cosmo, the band started to play, and she marveled that she hadn't noticed them when they were dressed in vibrant red satin, whereas he was little more than a shadow in his black suit. She and her sister hung on to each other. He opened his mouth, and the first note came out. For a split second, it was as if the audience had been turned off, just the flip of a switch, to let his low, clear voice ring out. And then the screaming was back, ratcheted up. Margaret could barely hear a word of that song, or the next. It hardly mattered. She was swept away in the magic, the charisma of the man at the center of it. Entranced. The opening ballad melted into a raucous, playful number, his careful restraint giving way to a frenzy of movement. At one point, he ran down the length of the stage, still singing, then stopped, tossed the microphone up, caught it behind him, and whipped it back to his lips to pick up singing like nothing had happened. Margaret waited for the energy in the room to wane. It didn't. Every time Laura looked at Margaret, her eyes alight, her wig slightly askew and cheeks flushed, one or both of them burst out laughing. They danced ferociously, sweat blooming under the synthetic fibers of their department store dresses. Margaret had brought a flask in her bag, and to her utter shock, Laura took her up on a few gulps when she held it out in offering. Once, when Cosmo did a particularly salacious swirl of his hips, Margaret leaned over and shouted against Laura's ear, "Roy!" And that alone was enough to set them off again. She couldn't hear her little sister's laughter over all that noise, but she could feel it in her chest, like an animal rousing from hibernation. How long had it been since she'd seen such reckless joy on Laura's face? Had she ever? Laura leaned in, arms around her sister's sweaty neck, and kissed the side of her face. "Thank you," she shouted. And suddenly, Margaret thought she might cry. Not those little leaking drips that came with laughter, either. She thought she might crack open and sob, but she couldn't let herself. So she just danced, hand in hand with her little sister, screaming and laughing and passing the flask between them as the best night of her entire life unfolded around her. 8 songs in, Cosmo finally played the song everyone had been waiting for, his biggest hit yet, "A Girl Back Home." Margaret had never seen anything like the fever that spread through the room as he danced and thrashed and yelped the song, "Ain't got no girl back home, no place in this world to call my own, but darling, for tonight, maybe we don't have to be alone." He slid forward on his knees right to the edge of the stage, and those first few rows erupted, gushing up toward him like a volcanic blast, their arms outstretched to him. Somehow, the screaming amped up further. Laura and Margaret pushed up on tiptoe, trying to get a look at what was happening. Cosmo had taken one girl's hand and was holding it in his while he sang. He lifted it and rubbed it against his cheek, and suddenly, all down the length of the stage, people were trying to climb up to him. In an instant, the energy in the room changed. There was a swell in the crowd behind them, like a typhoon moving from back to front, bodies pushing in tighter, people clamoring to get closer to him. Laura was knocked off balance, her shriek disappearing into the wall of sound. Margaret tried to move sideways to catch her sister by the arm, but there were already people moving between them, trying to shove their way closer to the stage. Anxiety knotted up her throat as she tried to push through. Instead, she was caught in the stampede, half carried deeper into the writhing throng. She screamed her sister's name as the tide of bodies pushed her farther from where she'd been. An errant elbow connected with her eye, and pain flared through her head, her vision blurring behind tears, all sense of balance lost to the dark. She had to fight just to stay upright as the crowd jostled her back and forth. A real panic filled her up when she realized how easy it would be to be crushed underfoot. She blinked away the tears in her left eye. Her right was already swelling. She reached up to her temple, and her hand came away with blood. Screaming for Laura again and again, she tried to fight her way back toward where they'd been standing, but she was turned around now, had traveled so far. The band had stopped playing. Police were moving in from the outside edges of the room, but the chaos wasn't dying down. She saw a flash of pink fabric in between the tightly packed bodies and struggled toward it, still screaming her sister's name. She pushed, she shoved. Some people pushed back. Her wig was yanked off. She didn't care. None of it mattered. The only thing that mattered was getting to that flash of pink before anything bad happened. She didn't yet know that something already had. Hands clamped down on her arms, and she struggled uselessly against the firm grip until she realized it was yanking her toward the side of the room, the man bulky enough to cut a path through the pandemonium. And then, there she was. Laura slumped against the wall, clutching the sides of her nose, her wig crooked, and blood dribbled down her collar, cheeks stained with tears. Margaret's heart plummeted into her stomach. She shook off her attacker and ran toward her sister. "Are you okay?" she asked, clutching her sister's cheeks.
"I'm fine, I'm fine," she croaked, but it was clearly a lie.
"Miss Ives!" someone shouted behind her, and she whirled back to face the man who'd hauled her over here, a security guard, and beside him, Darren, the Ives family's driver.
"What are you doing here?" she demanded.
"We need to get you both outside, Miss Ives," he said with a terse politeness, reaching for her arm.
She shook him off and went back to fretting over her sister.
"Let me see,"
she said, pulling on Laura's wrists to remove her hands from her face, taking in the swollen, bloody mass of her nose, and then, more disconcertingly, the teary blankness of her eyes. Did she have a concussion? Why did she look like that?
"Miss Ives," Darren said, more forcefully this time. "We have to go now."
She looked between her sister and him desperately. She wanted so badly to say, "No, we're not going. We're staying here in this perfect night." But the perfect night had blasted apart in a millisecond, turned into an outright brawl all around them. She gave Darren a nod, and he guided Laura from the wall, in against his side, with a grim look as he and the security guard rushed them toward a discreet side door. But on a night like that, there was no such thing as discreet. As soon as they stepped out into the night, the flashes of cameras popped all around them, voices shouting over one another, trying to get answers about what was happening inside, why people were fleeing, while simultaneously, police were streaming in. The security guard, who'd surely been generously compensated for his cooperation, tried to fend them off as Darren led the sisters to his car. But Laura was in such a daze that she lifted her head and blinked sorrowfully right as a flash went off. In a rage, Margaret stormed toward the man, demanding the film, going so far as to reach for his camera when he refused. Next thing she knew, there were a dozen more flashes going off in her face, and Darren's arms were dragging her back to the car, stuffing her inside with her sister. Her purse had gone flying at some point, but Darren threw that in after her before slamming the door shut. The flask was gone. She prayed she'd dropped it inside, not during the scrape with the photographer. Only once they were driving away did it all really hit her.
"How did you find us?"
she asked Darren. He didn't answer, merely kept his eyes on the dark road ahead of them.
"Did Daniel tell you?"
Beside her, Laura, who'd been hanging her head in shame, looked up, that startled blankness still splashed across her face.
"Laura, what is it?"
Her eyes shifted from the rearview mirror to Margaret guiltily. She swallowed.
"I told Gerald."
"You told Gerald?" It didn't sink in right away. When it did, she didn't get a chance to chastise Laura.
"He wouldn't have just sent for us like that unless it was important," Laura insisted. "I know he wouldn't."
She looked toward the mirror again, as if for backup. Darren kept his gaze astutely forward. Something new came over Laura's face. It went slack, her mouth opening.
"Darren,"
she said in a small, strained voice. He didn't meet her eyes. Dread gathered in Margaret's stomach now.
"Darren,"
Laura said more sharply.
"Yes, Miss Ives,"
he replied.
"What's happened?"
Margaret asked. Beside her, Laura began to weep even before the words left Darren's mouth.
"I'm sorry, miss," he said. "Your grandfather doesn't have long."
"I shouldn't have gone,"
Laura wheezed jaggedly.
"I knew I shouldn't have gone."
A sob scraped out of her, and Margaret pulled her in close, careful not to bump her bleeding face as she broke down fully in Margaret's lap. The world whirred furiously past the car windows, but still the drive seemed to last forever. They pulled up to the front of the house as the team of doctors was leaving. For some inane reason, Margaret took that as a good sign. Trouble averted, pain schooled into submission by the iron grip of the Ives patriarch. Laura knew better. She collapsed in the driveway at the sight of those white coats descending the steps. Margaret sank down in the gravel beside her, holding her sister as she trembled. 20 minutes. That was how long he had been dead already. Margaret's first thought had been a selfish one. She'll never forgive me. But she was wrong. That very night, her younger sister had slept beside her in her bed, or not slept, rather, but cried and hiccuped and cried some more, while Margaret stroked her hair and tried to think of soothing words that wouldn't be outright lies. "It will be okay" didn't feel right. Neither did "he's in a better place now," because who was she kidding? She had no idea if that was true. Instead, she murmured, "I'm here," over and over again like a prayer, until Laura's breathing finally evened out into the rhythm of sleep just before sunrise. The headlines were horrible. She shouldn't have gone looking, and ordinarily she wouldn't have, but since this was about Laura, she felt it was her duty. "Socialite sisters cavort at Cosmo's rock and brawl as grandfather dies," one rag proclaimed, beside a picture of the scene that had unfolded outside the arena, between her and the photographer who'd taken Laura's picture. One spot of luck was that in Margaret's efforts to take the man's camera, she'd become the shiny object at which all the others pointed their lenses, her face hideous in her fury, her hair slicked to her head so that it could fit beneath her wig, and her left eye nearly swollen shut. Another spot of luck? She and Laura were just one story after a night full of them. Most of the news Margaret pored over with her morning tea was more concerned with the melee of the concert and the sheer depravity of Cosmo's performance, which supposedly brought it on. The low, guttural singing, the wild dancing, and the moment he'd touched one concertgoer's hand to his cheek, which she'd seen every paper describe in its own wildly different way, including one confident assertion that he'd licked the woman's palm. On the one hand, there was a comfort in seeing the media criticizing someone other than her or her sister. On the other, now that she'd escaped last night's trance, the scales had abruptly fallen from her eyes concerning Cosmo Sinclair. She felt furious with him for his part in how everything had gone. One concerned clergyman had been quoted in an article calling him a Pied Piper leading young ladies to their doom, and while ordinarily this would have struck her as ridiculous, now she thought that uptight Puritan might have been on to something. She'd been stewing on this when Briggs, their butler, came into the breakfast room to inform her that she had a visitor. "I don't have anything on my calendar," she told him. "I know, ma'am," Briggs replied. "Then why did they let someone through the gate?" Briggs's face went red.
"I'm not sure he knew what else to do. Mr. Sinclair was adamant."
She dropped off, backtracked while she asked herself the question. He couldn't possibly mean that Sinclair, could he? By the tiny dip of Briggs's chin, yes, he did mean that Mr. Sinclair. She didn't remember standing, but she was standing nonetheless. "What does he want?"
"I'm not sure, ma'am," Briggs said.
She wavered for a moment, unsure what the best course of action would be. Then she remembered Laura sleeping up in her bed and had a thought. "Show him to the library," she told Briggs. "We'll be down shortly." Only several minutes later, as she sat on the edge of her bed, Laura, whose nose had been reset by a doctor last night and looked all the worse for it today, drew her legs up to her chest, wound her arms around them, and said,
"I'm not going down there."
"Oh, come on, Laura," Margaret said. "You look fine, much better than me." She waved a hand at her black eye, but Laura shook her head and lay back down.
"It's not about that," she said. I don't want to see Cosmo Sinclair. I don't want to think about him. I don't even want to listen to him anymore. For the rest of my life, that song will make me sick to my stomach. All he'll ever remind me of now is the night I lost my dearest friend.
Oh, how that had made her chest keen. There had been a time when Margaret had been Laura's best friend, but that didn't sting nearly so bad as the rest, the fact that her younger sister was now almost totally alone. Oh, sweetie, she cooed, smoothing one hand over Laura's head.
Just get rid of him, will you?
Laura said quietly. Of course. And Margaret went downstairs to do just that. 26. Hayden parks at my house on Thursday night after work, and we take the trail through the trees back to Rum Room with our laptop bags slung over our shoulders. Does it ever bother you, I ask, not being able to talk about what you're working on? Creases form at the insides of his brows.
Yeah, he admits. More lately.
Really? Why? I say. She finally getting to the good stuff? He gives me a look. I'm just kidding. This isn't a trap.
I know.
He slips his hand through mine, our knuckles locking together. After a minute, he says,
almost everything she tells me, I find myself imagining her telling you.
So competitive, I tease, bumping sideways into him.
I just wonder how you'd react, he replies. What you'd say, how you'd write it.
After a beat, he adds,
I think about your Bella Gerardi profile and realize you're probably getting entirely different stuff than I am, asking different questions.
I don't know, I shrug. I'm not really asking questions. I'm mostly just letting her talk. He gives me a strange look. What? I ask. He shakes his head, the grooves in his forehead smoothing out.
I just think we're having different experiences.
How so? I ask.
In a week, he says, I'll tell you.
A week? I cry. That's 2 days before she's going to choose one of us. Aren't you worried I'll scoop you?
Fine, he says. A week and 2 days. We give her our pitches, and then I'll tell you everything I legally can.
He stops walking, withdrawing his hand from mine, only to offer me a handshake. You want me to say the same thing? I ask.
That's up to you, he says.
I can really talk, I remind him. If I try to recap everything, you'll get sick of me before I'm halfway through. He grabs my hand, yanks me into him, and kisses me there in the middle of the dark path. That's a pretty good strategy, I whisper happily. At the ridge that forms in his forehead, I specify, for when I'm talking too much.
I'm not trying to shut you up, Alice, he says. It's just that somehow, almost everything you say makes me want to kiss you.
I laugh, but my heart is whirring like a helicopter attempting liftoff. I lace my hands against the back of his neck and grin up at him like the love-struck fool I'm quickly becoming. His own expression remains serious, and I just know he's thinking about next week, the week after that, an entire indefinite future with us on opposite sides of the country. Despite learning early on the merits of being present, of focusing only on the moment you're in rather than dreading all the ones that might follow, my grasp on this nearly perfect moment slips a little too. Come on, I start back down the path. Let's go eat. Rum Room is packed, but the patio is entirely empty, so the host inside at the stand tells us to take whichever picnic table we want. We choose one at the back edge, where we'll be more or less tucked out of sight, and set up our computers opposite each other. I know I should be working on my proposal, but I'm having trouble concentrating. Stay in the moment, Alice, I chide myself. Worry about tomorrow when it gets here. Easier said than done. Let's do something fun this weekend. I bat my laptop screen down for a better view of him. His left eyebrow curves upward.
Such as?
I don't know, I say. But we have Sunday off, let's do something. Some unspoken word balances on his bottom lip. What? I press. He considers carefully.
I wondered if you'd try to see your mom again.
Oh, right. I think it over. Next weekend. Then I'll either have good news to share with her or be done holding my breath and able to tell her I wrapped up my work here and am heading back to California. He nods, eyes back on the screen, but again, there's something he's not saying. Hayden.
It's none of my business,
he replies. I frown. Don't say that. I want you in my business. I'm inviting you into my business. His smile is half-formed and far from long-lasting. He's still tiptoeing. I promise, I add.
I guess I still don't understand why you don't want to tell her how you feel.
He hurries to tack on.
I want to understand, but I don't.
Now that I'm feeling less defensive, this line of questioning feels less like an attack. I am who I am, I explain. I like the things I like. I'm good at the things I'm good at. And my mom, she's her. Telling her that it hurts my feelings that she's not interested in my work won't change how she actually feels. She'll just act different. And I don't need that. I don't want her to pretend to think what I do has value. That would feel so much worse to me. He nods, tight-lipped, but I can tell it's an I understand, not an I agree. So that's it, I say.
Got it.
Under the table, his hand grazes over my knee. I think he means it to be calming, affectionate, but it sets me on fire. I seriously doubt I'm making it another full week without having him. Something possesses me to blurt out as much, and his hand tenses on my thigh, his eyes darkening. I shift forward to the very edge of the bench, his hand crawling higher along my skin, heat pulsing through me to the rhythm of the cricket song. Around the corner from us, the screen door bangs open, and Hayden's fingers retreat abruptly, right in time for a cute 20-something server with a top knot and Converse tennis shoes to bound out.
Hey, y'all,
she says brightly, pulling her notepad from her black half apron.
My name's True. What can I get started for you?
Hayden clears his throat.
Ice water.
I might need something a little stiffer,
I say, genuinely not aiming for a euphemism, but by his sudden cough, I know that's how it's received. I turn a guileless smile up to True.
Actually, we might need a minute,
I say, because clearly neither of us is quite fit for public consumption just yet.
Sure thing, she says. I'll be back in 5.
5 minutes, I tell myself, should be enough to make my body stop throbbing. After dinner, we don't even make it inside the rental before we're kissing, slipping hands beneath each other's shirts, whispering into each other's skin and mouths and hair. We pause long enough to fumble the lock open and stumble inside.
We're not going to have sex,
he tells me while his tongue is in the notch above my collarbone. We're not, I say, somewhere between alarm and complete disbelief. He shakes his head and pushes me toward the surface nearest the front door, the kitchen counter.
Not tonight.
He scrapes my shirt up over me and tosses it aside before lifting me onto the counter.
If you change your mind,
I say, reaching for him now,
let me know.
I throw his shirt over his shoulder, and then, as he's moving in between my thighs, I set a hand to the middle of his warm chest, holding him off.
Let me see you first.
His face screws up, and my heart clenches with the realization that he's shy about his body. You're beautiful, I tell him earnestly. His gaze lifts, the hard lines of his face cast in sharp relief. This time, when he steps in close, I reach for his waist and pull him nearer, our stomachs kissing as he eases me to the edge of the counter. His hands trail up the sides of my neck, then back down my chest, cupping me through my bra as our lips melt together and draw apart, our breath mingling. I slip one hand into his waistband, and he groans as my fingers curl around him. The sound drags down my spine like a fingernail, and I arch into him. One of his hands smooths around my back, makes its way up to the clasp of my bra, while the other brushes my skirt up my thighs and gently slides under me, the heel of his palm pressing into me. I cry out, my free hand gripping the back of his neck, seeking something firm and steadying as I move myself against him. My bra vanishes, his mouth connects with skin, our breathing frays, our pulses racing as we chase the sensations mounting everywhere we're connected. My chest aches with the need for more pressure, and I pitch myself forward, his mouth drawing me deeper. I gasp his name. He pushes me back the same way I did, one hand in the center of my chest, his splayed fingers nearly spanning the width of my ribcage. He looks at me hungrily, eyes dark as the Atlantic beneath a new moon. "Have you changed your mind yet?" I ask between breaths. In answer, he pulls me by the hips off the counter, turns me so that my back presses into the cold steel of the refrigerator, and thrusts his knee between my thighs, his mouth descending on my throat and his palms raking up my body. "Is that a yes?" I whisper. His hands pin themselves against my hips as he kneels on the tile in front of me, one hand bunching my skirt as the other tugs my underwear down. He leans in, his breath warm and eyes tilted up to watch my reaction as he presses his mouth to me. I forget all about the question. I forget all about every question that's been haunting me. I forget my name. I forget how to control my body or the words rasping from my throat. I forget everything that isn't Hayden, isn't this moment. We drink decaf. We eat the chess pie I got from the grocery store's bakery the other day. Okay, mostly I eat it, but he has a couple of bites. We try to work on our separate book proposals from our separate couches, and when that fails, try to play a game of Scrabble. And when that fails, we end up making out on the couch. And though mentally I really am trying to stop at making out, I find myself climbing down him, undoing his fly, drawing him into my mouth. His hand is gentle against the back of my head, the sounds emanating from him making my toes curl and thighs twinge all over again.
"God, Alice,"
he gravels out.
"I love this."
I pull back. "Me too." His eyes flick down to me, heavy-lidded, lust-drunk.
"You don't have to say that."
"I mean it," I insist. Even through the haze over his face, I catch a glimmer of skepticism. It occurs to me that in my effort to be positive, optimistic, and understanding, I might have made myself into an unreliable narrator of sorts, someone who can't easily be trusted not to sugarcoat things. A strange realization to have in this specific moment, but I guess wisdom doesn't have to choose when to foist itself on a person. "I promise," I whisper, his expression melting into something more raw, more vulnerable than before. His hand feather light in my hair. "I love touching you. I love kissing you. I love hanging out with you. I love this." He reaches for my face, draws me up the length of his body to kiss me sweetly, and I oblige, kiss him back until we're both writhing, until I can't bear going any longer without making him come. When I crawl back down him, his hips lift, letting me draw him into my mouth again, bring him to the edge, break him open the same way he breaks me open. The sound he makes is something I know I'll play back to myself later tonight while I'm lying awake, aching for more of him. His whole body. His whole heart, a little voice adds. I push it aside. Stay in the present. When we've finished, when he's drifted back into himself and pulled me up to lie against his chest, I murmur, "Tell me something no one knows about you." And he's quiet and still for so long, I start to wonder if I've crossed a line. Then he tips his chin down to his clavicle to meet my eyes and says simply,
"I'm in love with you."
I feel my lips part. Once I've absorbed it, I rush to reply, but he very lightly sets his fingertips against my mouth.
"I don't want you to say anything now,"
he murmurs. "Anything at all?" I whisper. The corners of his mouth twitch.
"Anything about that? Not until after."
I nod agreement, even as it feels like the words are climbing up my windpipe. "After." He kisses me once.
"Should we watch something?"
I blink back the rising tears and reach toward the coffee table for the remote. Almost Famous is on. I don't hear a word of it. My mind is an endless loop of I'm in love with you too. After more than 3 decades on this planet, all it took was a few weeks and the right person to entirely rearrange my composition. 27. On Friday, I take a nature trail that runs along the creek. I think of it as a run to clear my head, but since I stopped at Little Croissant beforehand and am also incredibly unathletic, it's really more of a mosey or an amble. A productive one, though. I decide to pitch structuring the book like a call and response, the rumors in the gossip rags of the time, followed by Margaret's confirmation or rebuttal. When I've finished the walk, I drive over to the enclave and wander the colorful gift shops, picking out small presents for Bianca, Killian, and Priya, tiny hand-painted wooden turtles, along with a postcard to send Audrey, since anything larger than that will just be something she has to find a way to store or send home. Afterward, I cross the drive to get a nice decaf and take up my post in the garden patio beneath Little Croissant's raised platform. Other than a couple in yoga gear and a teenage Bible study, I have the place to myself and a fully charged laptop. I'm more focused than I've been all week. The hours fly by, and it's nearly 4 p.m. when a jolly,
"Well, hey there, stranger,"
jolts me out of work mode. I blink against the sunlight until a gap-toothed smile resolves in front of me, along with a bulbous nose and a bucket hat.
"Cecil, hi!"
I rise to hug him on instinct, despite having absolutely never hugged this man before. He takes it in stride, hugs me back like we're the oldest friends in the world.
"How you been? Missed you, my half-birthday."
"Oh, sorry about that." I drop into my seat and wave for him to join me. He does.
"No, no worries. Honestly, I hear I had a bit too much to drink and did the Macarena on the bar, so it's probably for the best you weren't there."
"Now you're really making me wish I'd stayed." His wispy brows flick up.
"So you stopped by?"
"Yeah, we were there for a while, but then something came up."
"We?"
My cheeks heat. "Oh, my friend Hayden. I guess you met him?" He snaps his fingers.
"The other writer."
"Right," I say.
"So he missed the bar top dancing too?"
he asks hopefully. I laugh. "He did. Although I think anyone reading about that would only be more excited about Little Crescent."
"Oh, no."
He waves a hand.
"Not the 4 p.m. dinner crowd. Most of them know better. I'm lucky I made it through the night without breaking my new hip. Now, tell me, Alice, how are you finding our little island?"
"It's great," I say, honestly.
"You did okay with the storm?"
he says. "That sprinkle the other night?" I say. He guffaws, slapping the table as he lumbers to his feet.
"Knew I liked you. Hey, if you see your friend Hayden, tell him I found that picture we were talking about."
"Picture?" I say.
"An old photograph," Cecil says. "He and I got to talking, and I told him about how I used to have hair down to my waist in the 70s. He wanted to see the proof."
He stops and laughs gruffly to himself.
"I'm sure he was just humoring an old man, but..."
I'm torn between trying to get more information and feeling like that's somehow cheating in this strange competition Hayden and I have found ourselves in. Because if I know anything about him, he's not just humoring Cecil. He doesn't do that, which means he had a real reason for asking to see this picture. Or else he didn't ask at all and Cecil just volunteered it, another distinct possibility. Though with how direct Hayden tends to be, I'm really not convinced that's what's going on. I tamp my curiosity down. "I'll tell him," I promise, and Cecil raps his knuckles on the table before turning and strolling away. Hayden lowers his fork from his mouth, the bite of diner hash brown still dangling from it.
"A picture?"
he asks. That's what he said. One side of his mouth inches up.
"And you just let that go, did you?"
I fold my arms atop the sticky table. "Actually, I did. It felt like cheating." He sits back, dabbing his mouth with a napkin.
"I don't want you to do your job any differently because of me."
"It's fine," I say. "It's a lead you chased down."
"I never said it was a lead,"
he points out. "Is it?" I try to arch my brow at him. A quiet grunt of laughter escapes him.
"You're bad at that."
"Well, I can't be perfect at everything, I guess," I say wistfully. He sits forward again, his hand settling over my kneecaps under the table.
"You could have asked him."
"What if I ask you instead?" I say. His head tips, and he draws in a breath between his parted lips. Never mind, I say.
Ask to see the picture, he says intently, then adds, it might not mean anything to you. It might not mean anything, period. But I'll tell you why I wanted to see it. After.
Not after you see it, I know, but after we know how this ends. I stretch one hand out over the table, another handshake agreement in a series of them. His hand eclipses mine, and I pull it across the table to press a kiss to the back of it, the only way I can keep myself from blurting, I love you. The tender expression that dawns across his severe features makes me think he heard the words all the same. On Saturday morning, on my way out the door, I run back inside and dig through the stack of junk by the front door until I find Captain Cecil's card. I fire off a quick text, and then I head over to Margaret's. Since Hayden's and my arrival, she has apparently let her regular exercise fall to the wayside, which is how she convinced me that today's interview should largely be conducted from her swimming pool. I wish I'd packed a sensible one-piece, but being me, I've only brought a skimpy hot sauce red bikini. The least professional swimwear, arguably, but will make do. I sit on the edge of the sun-drenched pool, my legs in the water, and set up my recording devices beside me. At the far end of the pool, she shrugs off her robe and tosses it onto a lounger to reveal a canary yellow tankini, and I'm instantly less self-conscious about my own sartorial choices. I love your suit, I call to her as she descends the steps, clinging to the metal handrail.
Right back at you, she says. I tend to trust people who love color. Shows good judgment, don't you think?
I can't tell if that's a compliment to me, a jab toward Hayden, both or neither. Stranger, I can't tell which I want it to be. It's a good thing if she trusts me. I want this job. But if she's implying that Hayden in his understated, monochromatic wardrobe isn't trustworthy, then I'm having a hard time not being a little offended. Shit. Maybe he's been right all along. Maybe this is all stickier than I realize. It's just one more week. Either way, things will be settled very soon. I grab my notebook and pen and stack them on my thighs as Margaret begins wading back and forth, arms akimbo. So, I say, clearing my throat, we'd just gotten to
Cosmo,
she interrupts, still sloshing back and forth.
We'd finally gotten to Cosmo.
The story. Their version. For Cosmo Sinclair and Margaret Grace Ives, it was love at first sight. Her version. She hated him. She blamed him. She didn't care whether it was fair or not. She went down to the library with the intention of eviscerating him. She threw open both doors for dramatic purposes and stormed into the room like a heat-seeking missile. He'd been looking at one of the many shelves of Gerald's unread books, and when he turned toward the sound, his quiet smile was disarming. She stumbled, just for a second, before resuming her march.
Hello, ma'am, he said. I'm Cosmo.
The southern lilt of his voice surprised her. She'd heard the accent in his stage chatter, of course, but much of it had been buried beneath thousands of screaming voices, and what she had heard, she'd assumed was a put-on, an exaggeration. It wasn't. I know who you are, she said. Then, why are you here?
I came to apologize, he replied.
At that point, she noticed the small bouquet hanging from his hand, a bundle of white lily of the valley, knotted with twine.
Apologize?
She repeated, befuddled. He came toward her, his slick shoes clicking on the floorboards, and presented the bouquet, almost sheepishly. Everything about him was a bit sheepish, actually. What could have passed for cool aloofness from a distance struck her now as shyness.
I saw the paper this morning, he said, letting the bouquet hover between them. Felt awful about what happened to you and your sister and everyone else. Things got out of hand.
Oh, I see. She forced her shoulders away from her ears. You're here to kiss the ring. His brows pinched.
Ma'am?
You can relax. Our family's papers won't have any vendetta against you, she assured him, though personally she couldn't say the same. She wasn't angry enough to try to tank his career, just angry enough to be rude. He shifted between his feet, the bouquet falling back down to his side. He seemed uncomfortable in his body, as if he'd grown too quickly, in stature or frame or both, and wasn't quite sure how to move through the world. He looked younger than he had on stage, too, so young that she couldn't help but ask, in that seemingly random moment, "How old are you?" If he was surprised or offended that she, someone fan enough to attend the concert, didn't already know, he didn't show it. Laura probably knew his exact birth date, his associated birthstone, what kind of car he drove, and what his dog was called. Not that Laura cared anymore.
23, ma'am, he said.
Only 3 years older than her. It made his performance the night before all the more shocking. How could he look so at home on a stage in front of thousands, thrusting his hips and screaming his heart out, but become such a quiet, mild-tempered boy in this room with only her?
I was raised never to ask a lady her age, he said, the tiny smile on his full lips surprising her.
I'm 20, she volunteered, for God only knows what reason. He stepped a little closer.
Did you enjoy the show?
He asked in that hypnotic murmur.
Before all that hubbub, I mean.
His dark eyes shone with an eagerness that surprised her, as if the answer mattered very much. She wanted to lie, but she wasn't a liar. She settled on an obfuscation.
I'd never seen anything like it.
His smile twitched across his lips, but faded quickly. He reached toward her, and she flinched for just a second before she realized he was merely brushing his fingers lightly along the edge of her bruised eye, a frown deepening the grooves in his forehead. His eyes flicked back to hers.
Will you come again tonight?
He said quietly. Her stomach flipped nonsensically as their sudden eye contact jolted her back into reality.
What?
To the last concert, he said. Police will be there this time. Can't promise it'll be a good show, but it'll be a safer one at least.
Oh.
She looked away, and his calloused fingertips fell from her face.
I'm not sure.
Your sister too, of course, he volunteered. We can bring you all backstage where no one can see you. You can watch from the wings.
Her heart soared, only to crash when she remembered what Laura had told her upstairs. Was that really only minutes ago? It felt like days, weeks. In a way she couldn't understand, and certainly couldn't have expressed, Margaret felt as if the story of her life had been written onto a piece of paper she'd only just now realized had been folded in half. Now it was open, a full second half of a page appearing abruptly, with a sharp crease dividing this new chapter from what came before. Laura's words dropped through her like a cold stone. All he'll ever remind me of now is the night I lost my dearest friend, settling in the pit of her stomach.
Laura won't be able to make it, she said.
But you?
The way his eyebrows pitched up in the middle, tenting hopefully, made something in her stomach feel like it was unraveling.
Fine, she said.
A smile broke across his face, bright as dawn, and he lifted the bouquet toward her again. This time, she took it. He won her over that night. Truthfully, that was all it had taken. He'd come off that stage, drenched in sweat, and caught up in the thrill of it all. When he strode purposefully toward her, she'd pitched herself into his arms, intending only to hug him, to praise the performance. But as soon as his strong arms came around her and his heat and scent hit her, it was as if she'd hopped universes, moved parallel into one where the plan had always been to kiss him, just as his had always been to kiss her. His band made a couple of little hoots and whistles, but the sound of the audience still cheering out in the dark amphitheater ate away at their teasing, and even if it hadn't, she likely wouldn't have registered it. She'd stopped registering anything but him. When he drew back, his fingers falling from her jaw, he took her hand and pulled her through the narrow backstage hallway all the way to his dressing room.
I don't do this, she said, as, together, they pushed the door shut behind them.
I do, he said.
Fine, she said. I do too.
Because of that, she thought she was safe, insulated. This would be one more wild night, a private story that would belong just to her in a life that she largely lived as a worldwide broadcast. It couldn't be more than that, if for no other reason than she refused to subject Laura to Cosmo's presence. So it was just one night. And in the morning, when he sent her dozens of bouquets, each one a different flower, with a note that read, "Didn't know what you liked, see," she told herself that was just an addendum to the night itself. Laura continued her grieving. Gerald had left her his father's old journals, and all day